I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap, and I'm reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Rinehart. In the words of the introduction to Tenting Tonight, Mary Roberts Rinehart, in her two trips to Glacier National Park during the early years of the 20th century, well before the park was a popular destination, offers clear evidence of her venturesome spirit. Rinehart documented these two adventures, led by dude rancher Howard Eaton of Wolf, Wyoming, in the pair of delightful travelogues, Through Glacier Park, 1916, and Tenting Tonight, 1918. Chapter 13, Canyon Fishing and a Telegram. It was 11 o'clock the next morning before I led Buddy. I had abandoned Budweiser in view of the drought, into a mountain stream and let him drink. He would have rolled in it too, but I was on his back and I fiercely restrained him. The next day was a comparatively short trip, but there was a trapper's cabin at the fork of Bridge Creek in the Stehekin River. There we were to spend the night before starting on our way to Cascade Pass. As it turned out, we spent 2 days there. There was a little grass for the horses, and we learned of a canyon some 5 or 6 miles off our trail, which was reported as full of fish. The most ardent of us went there the next day, Mr. Hilligoss, Weaver, and Silent Lowry, and the Freds, and Bob, and the big boy, and the little boy, and Joe, and without expecting it, we happened on adventure. Have you ever climbed down a canyon with rocky sides, a straight and precipitous 500 feet, clinging with your fingernails to any bit of green that grows from the cliff, and to footholds made by an axe, and carrying a fly book and a trout rod, which is an infinitely precious trout rod? Also a share of the midday lunch and 20 pounds more weight than you ought to have by the beauty scale? Because unless you have, you will never understand that trip. It was a series of wild drops, of blood-curdling escapes, of slips and recoveries, of bruises and abrasions. But at last we made it, and there was the river. I have still in mind a deep pool where the water, rushing at tremendous speed over a rocky ledge, fell perhaps 15 feet. I had fixed my eyes on that pool early in the day, but it seemed impossible of access. To reach it, it was necessary again to scale a part of the cliff, and clinging to its face, to work one's way around a ledge perhaps 3 inches wide. When I had once made it, with the aid of friendly hands and a leather belt by which I was lowered, I knew one thing, knew it inevitably. I was there for life. Nothing would ever take me back over that ledge. However, I was there, and there was no use wasting time, for there were fish there. Now and then they jumped, but they did not take the fly. The water seethed and boiled, and I stood still and fished, because a slip on that spray-covered ledge, and I was gone, to be washed down to Lake Chelan and lie below sea level in the Cascade Mountains, which might be a glorious sort of tomb, but it did not appeal to me. I tried different flies with no result. At last, with a weighted line and a fish's eye, I got my first fish, the best of the day, and from that time on I forgot the danger. Some day, armed with every enticement known to the fishermen, I am going back to that river. For there, under a log, lurks the wiliest trout I have ever encountered. In full view he stayed during the entire time of my sojourn. He came up to the fly, leaped over it, made faces at it. Then he would look up at me scornfully. "Old tricks," he seemed to say. "Old stuff, not good enough." I dare say he is still there. Late in the day we got out of that canyon, got out at infinite peril and fatigue, climbed, struggled, stumbled, held on, pulled. I slipped once and had a bad knee for 6 weeks. Never once did I dare to look back down. It was always up, and the top was always receding. And when we reached camp, the head, who had been on an excursion of his own, refused to be thrilled and spent the evening telling how he had been climbing over the top of the world on his hands and knees. In sheer scorn we let him babble. But my hat is off to him, after all, for he had ready for us, and swears to this day its truth, the best fish story of the trip. Lying on the top of one of our packing cases was a great bull trout. Now a bull trout has teeth, and held in a vice-like grip in the teeth of this one was a smaller trout. In the mouth of the smaller was a gray and black fly. The head maintained that he had hooked the small fish and was about to draw it to shore when the bull trout leaped out of the water, caught the small fish, and held on grimly. The head, thereupon, had landed them both. In proof of this, as I have said, he had the two fish on top of a packing case. But it is not a difficult matter to place a small trout crosswise in the jaws of a bull trout, and to this day we are not quite certain. There were tooth marks on the little fish, but as one of the guides said, he wouldn't put it past the head to have made them himself. That night we received a telegram. I remember it with great distinctness, because the man who brought it charged $15 for delivering it. He came at midnight, and how he had reached us no one will ever know. The telegram notified us that a railroad strike was about to take place and that we should get out as soon as possible. Early the next morning we held a conference. It was about as far back as it was to go ahead over the range, and before us still lay the great adventure of the pass. We took a vote on it at last, and the ayes carried. We would go ahead, making the best time we could. If the railroads had stopped when we got out, we would merely turn our pack outfit toward the east and keep on moving. We had been all summer in the saddle by that time, and a matter of 3,500 miles across a continent seemed a trifle. Dan DeVore brought us other news that morning, however. Cascade Pass was closed with snow. A miner who lived alone somewhere up the gorge had brought in the information. That was a serious moment. We could get to Doubtful Lake, but it was unlikely we could get any farther. The comparatively simple matter thus became a complicated one, for Doubtful Lake was not only a detour, it was almost inaccessible, especially for the horses. But we hated to acknowledge defeat, so again we voted to go ahead. That day, while the pack outfit was being got ready, I had a long talk with the forest supervisor. He told me many things about our national forest, things which are worth knowing and which every American, whose playgrounds the forest are, should know. In the first place, the forestry department welcomes the camper. He is given his liberty absolutely. He's allowed to hunt such game as in season, but two restrictions are placed on him. He shall leave his campground clean, and he shall extinguish every spark of fire before he leaves. Beyond that, it is the policy of the government to let campers alone. It is possible, in a national forest, to secure a special permit to put up buildings for permanent camps. An act passed on the 4th of March, 1915, gives the camper a permit for a definite period, although until that time the government could revoke the permit at will. The rental is so small it is practically negligible. All roads and trails are open to the public. No admission can be charged on a national forest, and no concession will be sold. The whole idea of the national forest as a playground is to administer it to the public interest. Good lots on Lake Chelan can be obtained for from $5 to $25 a year, depending on their locality. It is the intention of the government to pipe water to those allotments. For the hunters, there is no protection for bear, cougar, coyotes, bobcat, and lynx. No license is required to hunt them. And to the persistent hunter who goes into the woods, not as we did, with an outfit the size of a cavalry regiment, there is game to be had in abundance. We saw goat tracks in numbers at Cloudy Pass, and the marks of bruin everywhere. The Chelan National Forest is well protected against fires. A fire launch patrols the lake, and lookouts are stationed all the time on Strong Mountain and Kroll's Hill. They live there at the summits, where provisions and water must be carried up to them. These lookouts now have telephones, but until last summer they used the heliograph instead. So now prepared, having made our decision to go on, that night, if the trail was possible, we would camp at Doubtful Lake. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap, and I'm reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. Chapter 14, Doing the Impossible. The first part of that adventurous day was quiet. We moved sedately along on overgrown trail, mountain walls so close on each side that the valley lay in shadow. I rode next to Dan DeVore that day, and on the trail he stopped his horse and showed me the place where Huey McKeever was found. Dan DeVore and Huey McKeever went out one November to go up to Horseshoe Basin. Dan left before the heaviest snows came, leaving McKeever alone. When McKeever had not appeared by February, Dan went in for him. His cabin was empty. He had kept a diary up to the 24th of December when it stopped abruptly. There were a few marten skins in the cabin and his outfit. That was all. In some cottonwoods, not far from the camp, they found his hatchet and his bag hanging to a tree. It looked for a time as though the mystery of Huey McKeever's disappearance would be one of the unsolved tragedies of the mountains. But a trapper whose route took him along Thunder Creek that spring noticed that his dog made a side trip each time away from the trail. At last he investigated and found the body of Huey McKeever. He had probably been caught in a snowslide, for his leg was broken below the knee. Unable to walk, he had put his snowshoes on his hands and, dragging the broken leg, had crawled 6 miles through the snow and ice of a winter. When he was found, he was only a mile and a half from his cabin in safety. There are many other tragedies of that valley. There was a man who went up Bridge Creek to see a claim he had located there. He was to be out 4 days, but in 10 days he had not appeared, which was not surprising, for there was 25 feet of snow, and when the snow had frozen so that rescuers could travel over the crust, they went up after him. He was lying on one of the bunks of his cabin, with a mattress over him, frozen to death. So, Dan said, they covered him in the snow with a mattress and went back in the spring to bury him. Every winter in those mountain valleys, men who cannot get their outfits out before the snow shoot their horses or cut their throats rather than let them freeze or starve to death. It is a grim country, the Cascade Country. One man shot 9 in this very valley last winter. Our naturalist had been caught the winter before in the first snowstorm of the season. He was from daylight until 8 o'clock at night making 2 miles of trail. He had to break it foot by foot for the horses. As we rode up the gorge toward the pass, it was evident from the amount of snow in the mountains that stories had not been exaggerated. The packers looked dubious. Even if we could make the climb to Doubtful Lake, it seemed impossible that we could get farther. But the monotony of the long ride was broken that afternoon by our first sight as a party of a bear. It came out on a ledge of the mountain, perhaps 300 yards away, and proceeded with great deliberation to walk across a rock slide. It paid no attention whatever to us, and to the wild excitement which followed its discovery. Instantly the 3 junior Reinhardts were off their horses, and our artillery attack was being prepared. At the first shot, the pack ponies went crazy. They lunged and jumped, and even Buddy showed sign of strain, leaping what I imagined to be some 11 feet in the air and coming back on 4 rigid knees. Followed such a peppering of that cliff as it had never had before. Little clouds of rock dust rose above the bear, in front of him, behind him, and below him. He stopped, mildly astonished, and looked around. More noise, more bucking on the trail, more dust. The bear walked on a trifle faster. It had been arranged that the first bear was to be left for the juniors, so the packers and the rest of the party watched and advised. But, as I have related elsewhere in this narrative, there were no casualties. The bear, as far as I know, is living today, an honored member of his community, and still telling how he survived the Great War. At last he disappeared into a cave, and we went on without so much as a single skin to decorate a college room. We went on. What odds and ends of knowledge we picked up on those long days in the saddle. That if lightning strikes a pine even lightly, it kills, but that a fir will ordinarily survive. That mountain miles are measured air line, so that 25 miles may really be 40, and that even then they are calculated on the level, so that one is credited with only the base of the triangle while he is laboriously climbing up its hypotenuse. I am personally acquainted with the hypotenuses of a great many mountains, and there is no use trying to pretend that they are bases. They are not. Then we learned that the purpose of the National Forest is not to preserve timber, but to conserve it. The idea is to sell and reseed. About 25% of the timber we saw was yellow pine, but most of the timber we saw on the east side of the Cascades will be safe for some time. I wouldn't undertake to carry out, from most of that region, enough pine needles to make a sofa cushion. It is quite enough to get oneself out. Up to now it had been hard going, but not impossible. Now we were to do the impossible. It is a curious thing about mountains, but they have a hideous tendency to fall down. Whole cliff faces, a mile or so high, are suddenly seized with a wandering disposition. Leaving the old folks at home and sliding down into the valleys, they come awful croppers and sustain 11 million compound comminuted fractures. These family breaks are known as rock slides. Now to travel 20 feet over a rock slide is to twist an ankle, bruise a shin bone, utterly discourage a horse, and sour the most amiable disposition. There is no flat side to these wandering rocks. With the diabolical ingenuity that nature can show when she does wrong, they lie edge up. Do you remember the little mermaid who wished to lose her tail and gain legs so she could follow the prince, and how her penalty was that every step was like walking on the edges of swords? That is a mountain rock slide. But I do not recall that the little mermaid had to drag a frightened and slipping horse which stepped on her now and then, or wear riding boots, or stop every now and then to be photographed, and to try to persuade her horse to stop also, or to keep looking up to see if another family jar threatened, or look around to see if any of the party or the pack was rolling down over the spare ribs of that ghastly skeleton. No, the little mermaid's problem was a simple and uncomplicated one. We were climbing, too. Only one thing kept us going. The narrow valley twisted, and around each cliff face we expected the end, either death or solid ground. But not so, or at least not for some hours. Riding boots peeled like a sunburnt face, stones dislodged and rolled down, the sun beat down in early September fury, and still we went on. Only 3 miles it was, but it was as bad a 3 miles as I have ever covered. Then the naturalist turned and smiled. "Now we are all right," he said. "We start to climb soon." Chapter 15. Doubtful Lake. Of all the mountain climbing I have ever done, the switchback up to Doubtful Lake is the worst. We were hours doing it. There were places when it seemed no horse could possibly make the climb. Back and forth, up and up along that narrow, rock-filled trail, which was lost here in a snowbank, there in a jungle of evergreen that hung out from the mountainside, we were obliged to go. There was no going back. We could not have turned a horse around, nor could we have reversed the pack outfit without losing some of the horses. As a matter of fact, we dropped 2 horses on that switchback. With infinite labor, the packers got them back to the trail, rolling, tumbling, and roping them down to the ledge below, and there salvaging them. It was heartbreaking, nerve-wracking work. Near the top was an ice patch across a brawling waterfall. To slip on that ice patch meant a drop of incredible distance. From broken places in the crust, it was possible to see the stream below. Yet over the ice, it was necessary to take ourselves and the pack. "Absolutely no riding here," was the order given in strained tones, for everybody's nerves were on edge. Somehow or other, we got over. I can still see one little pack pony wandering away from the others and traveling across that tiny ice field on the very brink of death at the top of the precipice. The sun had softened the snow so that I fell flat into it, and there was a dreadful moment when I thought I was going to slide. Even when I was safely over, my anxieties were just beginning, for the head and the juniors were not yet over, and there was no space to stop and see them come. It was necessary to move on up the switchback that the next horse behind might scramble up. Buddy went gallantly on, leaping, slipping, his flanks heaving, his nostrils dilated. Then, at last, the familiar call. "Are you all right, Mother?" And I knew it was all right with them, so far. 3,000 feet that switchback went straight up in the air. How many thousand feet we traveled back and forward, I do not know. But these things have a way of getting over somehow. The last of the pack horses was 3 hours behind us in reaching Doubtful Lake. The weary little beasts, cut, bruised, and by this time very hungry, looked dejected and forlorn. It was bitterly cold. Doubtful Lake was floating full of ice, and a chilling wind blew on us from the snow all about. A bear came out on the cliff face across the valley, but no one attempted to shoot at him. We were too tired, too bruised and sore. We gave him no more than a passing glance. It had been a tremendous experience, but a most alarming one. From the brink of that pocket on the mountaintop, where we stood, the earth fell away to vast distances beneath. The little river which empties Doubtful Lake slid greasily over a rock and disappeared without a sound into the void. Until the pack outfit arrived, we could have no food. We built a fire and huddled around it, and now and then one of us would go to the edge of the pit which lay below to listen. The summer evening was over and night had fallen before we heard the horses coming near the top of the cliff. We cheered them as one by one they stumbled over the edge, dark figures of horses and men, the animals with their bulging packs. They had put up a gallant fight. And we had no food for the horses. The few oats we had been able to carry were gone, and there was no grass on the little plateau. There was heather, deceptively green, but nothing else. And here, for the benefit of those who may follow us along the trail, let me say that oats should be carried, if two additional horses are required for the purpose, carried and kept in reserve for the last hard days of the trip. The two horses that had fallen were unpacked first. They were cut, and on their cuts the head poured iodine, but that was all we could do for them. One little gray mare was trembling violently. She went over a cliff again the next day, but I am glad to say that we took her out finally, not much the worse except for a badly cut shoulder. The other horse, a sorrel, had only a day or two before slid 500 feet down a snowbank. He was still stiff from his previous accident, and if ever I saw a horse whose nerve was gone, I saw one there, a poor, tragic, shaken creature trembling at a word. That night, while we lay wrapped in blankets round the fire, while the cooks prepared supper at another fire nearby, the optimist produced a bottle of claret. We drank it out of 10 cups, the only wine of the journey, and not until long afterward did we know its history, that a very great man to whose faith the Northwest owes much of its development had purchased it 25 years before for the visit to this country of Albert, King of the Belgians. That claret, taken so casually from 10 cups near the summit of the Cascades, had been a part of the store of that great dreamer, James J. Hill, laid in for the use of that other great dreamer and idealist, Albert, when he was his guest. While we ate, Weaver said suddenly, "Listen." His keen ears had caught the sound of a bell. He got up. "Either Johnny or Buck," he said, "starting back home." Then commenced again that heartbreaking task of rounding up the horses. That is a part of such an expedition, and even at that, one escaped and was found the next morning high up the cliffside in a basin. It was too late to put up all the tents that night. Mrs. Fred and I slept in our clothes, but under canvas, and the men lay out with their faces to the sky. Toward dawn a thunderstorm came up, for we were on the crest of the Cascades now, where the rain clouds empty themselves before traveling to the arid country to the east. Just over the mountain wall above us lay the Pacific slope. The rain came down, and around the peaks overhead lightning flashed and flamed. No one moved except Joe, who sat up in his blankets, put on his hat, and said, "Let her rain," and lay down to sleep again. Peanuts, the naturalist horse, sought human companionship in the storm and wandered into camp, where one of the young bear hunters wakened to find him stepping across his prostrate and blanketed form. Then all was still again, except for the solid beat of the rain on canvas and blanket, horse and man. It cleared toward morning, and at dawn Dan was up and climbed the wall on foot. At breakfast, on his return, we held a conference. He reported that it was possible to reach the top, possible but difficult, and that what lay on the other side we should have to discover later on. A night's sleep had made Joe all business again. On the previous day he had been too busy saving his camera and his life, camera first, of course, to try for pictures, but now he had a brilliant idea. "Now see here," he said to me, "I've got a great idea. How's Buddy about water?" "Well, he's partial to it," I admitted. "For drinking, or for lying down and rolling in it, especially when I'm on him." "Why?" "Well, it's like this," he observed. "I'm set up on the bank of the lake, see? And you ride him into the water and get him to scramble up on one of those ice cakes. Do you get it? It'll be a whale of a picture." "Joe," I said in a stern voice, "did you ever try to make a horse go into an icy lake and climb on an ice cake? Because if you have, you can do it now. I can turn the camera all right. Anyhow," I added firmly, "I've been photographed enough. This film is going to look as if I crossed the Cascades alone. Some of you other people ought to have a chance." But a moving picture man after a picture is as determined as a cook who does not like the suburbs. I rode Buddy to the brink of the lake, and there spoke to him in friendly tones. I observed that this lake was like other lakes, only colder, and that it ought to be mere play after the day before. I also selected a large ice cake, which looked fairly solid, and pointed Buddy at it. Then I kicked him. He took a step and began to shake. Then he leaped 6 feet to one side and reared, still shaking. Then he turned round and headed for camp. By that, I was determined on the picture. There is nothing like two wills set in opposite direction to determine a woman. Buddy and I again and again approached the lake, mostly sideways. But at last he went in, took 20 steps out, felt the cold on his poor empty belly, and refused the ice cake. We went out much faster than we went in, making the bank in a great bound and a very bad humor. Two very bad humors. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap. I've been reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Reinhardt, which was republished in 2002 by Riverbend Publishing, Helena, Montana, in cooperation with the Montana Historical Society. Bookshelf is a feature of Spokane Public Radio. Vern Windham and Nancy Roth, executive producers, producer Caitlin Maroney.